There you go, ladies and gentlemen. The solo saxophone of Patrick Brennan and a piece called Tilting Curvaceous. Now, if you were listening earlier to our broadcast, you heard him explain how he's taken the concepts that he had developed in his band down through the years and tried to translate them to the solo saxophone. And the vocabulary was really clear there. That was very, very understandable, beautiful, swinging thing. I enjoyed that very, very much. And after you explained it earlier, too, it's easier to hear exactly what you're doing more. I mean, you can draw me in a little bit better with that understanding.
Yeah, there's something to be said for that mystery of not knowing what it is you're hearing, but there's also something to be said for having some idea of what it is.
Just a toehold.
Yeah.
Because just a toehold is enough to get you started in, and then you're going to take me somewhere that I didn't expect to go. But it helps to have something that's going to get you to ride on your music with you, because otherwise it's just listening. I mean, it's just hearing. It's not listening, so... Now, with that in mind, you have a chance to hear Patrick's solo saxophone this Saturday, February 21st at 8 p.m. at Mexican Sans Frontiers, 120 South Division, number 226 upstairs there in Grand Rapids. And solo saxophone concert coming up at 8, but during the day, some of the musical concepts that Patrick's been explaining so far on this broadcast will be elaborated upon in great detail in a workshop from 2 to 5. Can you tell us a little bit about your appearance then?
Yeah, this workshop is called Musical Transparencies, and it reflects a related strategy to the things that we were talking about, which I call transparencies. Now, transparencies is an easy idea. If you think about it in terms of printing or something, you take different layers and you overlay them, and then you get different composites out of that. So one of the things I've thought about a lot is how do you make something that on a composite level is really coherent and really speaks to the listener and satisfies on as many levels as possible, but the organization can still be decentralized. And that is, and also in another way, in the sense that, you know, in the same way in terms of organizing for musicians, how do you give them enough specificity that you can get that, but not so much that it impairs what they're capable of contributing, because you could certainly overload a musician and then it freezes up the entire process. So transparencies was something that I evolved back in the 90s, where I got this idea that's a little bit like, actually, I remember even having the idea when I was a teenager, but I didn't think of it as a music. I hadn't found a place yet. And it's like kind of like the game of telephone. Right? Person A tells person B, person B tells B, C the story, and person C tells person D the story. And by the time you've gotten out there, the story has completely transformed itself into something else. And that kind of way that information changes fascinates me, because it's not always about being right. It's just like your personality or your style is as much about your deficiencies and your weaknesses. That's what makes you distinct. If everybody were perfect, there wouldn't be anything interesting. But also that way that communication is not perfect is a huge opportunity for new developments. That's where we get serendipity. That's where we get surprises. That's where we get new insights. It's often by accident, but with a certain degree of awareness that these things penetrate. So the transparency idea, I said, well, what happened, being as interested as I am in sort of a synthesizing, let's call it bebop language or melodic language with African notions of polyrhythm by way of Elvin Jones, but saying, how can you get a whole band to work on that kind of level of rhythmic sophistication, but have the melodies so clear that, you know, they'll unambiguously take you there. That's a compositional problem. So the idea of transparencies was, so let's say you take one pattern and you superimpose another pattern. Well, that makes a certain gestalt, a certain kind of thing. But what if you remove the first one and then you write another pattern against that one, and then you'd keep doing that? So that was the idea compositionally of making transparencies. And then a few other things were, you know, during
the... Isn't that like 5 against 4 or 3 against...
Things like that, for example.
Like those rhythmic exercises,
right?
You learn.
Yeah, things like that. But okay, also in terms of melody. So you can completely change the tonal inflection or the general dynamic of... You emphasize other features of, say, the target line with the other ones, because it can be done a lot of other ways. If you think about Ornette Coleman, one of the things that... I don't understand harmonics, but I've always tried, you know, that idea that you can hear a phrase or a pitch with multiple meanings. So I go, well, how can you downstep that a little bit, that you have a kind of a selection of multiple meanings, at least as your initial reference?
It's kind of like cubism.
A little bit like that. Yeah, it is actually related. And if you think about, Cubism's theft debt to African art, mm-hmm. you know, the whole, that whole particular concept. Then you look into the music and you look into the dynamic use of contrast in, generally in African aesthetics, you can see the crossovers. And it is very much a aesthetically black thing that's a global thing as well, just like anything else from anywhere else.
But it sounds to me like you are centralizing this a little bit, that there is a certain, you know, chart or a way of navigating through the sounds that you're pointing people towards.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they have freedom to, just like anything else where you have freedom to choose from, but
right.
What's the material you would be right. choosing?
You have a common reference point. Mm-hmm. So in the case of transparencies, I wrote several compositions over a period of years that I thought, well, okay, these things can assemble and create different kinds of faces, you know, this pattern with this pattern, that pattern. So then musicians have these sets of patterns and they can choose from among these patterns,
oh, I see.
Whichever ones they play. Mm-hmm. And then some other insights came just in the last year or so. You know, I've thought a lot about Butch Morris since he died.
Because mm-hmm.
I worked with Butch a little bit, but Butch wasn't using saxophone, so I always felt a little left out. But
what'd you play?
I didn't play much because he kept saying, let me know when you get a bassoon.
Ah!
You know?
Yeah, like double reeds are really, really like an alto.
Yeah, I mean, there's an orchestral thing. Saxophones have a tendency to hog up the sound of an ensemble more than anything else. And so, I mean, there are other people with large ensembles now who aren't using saxophones. And some of it is that they don't want it to sound like the buzzword jazz. And in some sense, I think it's because just saxophones absorb the overtones in a certain way. And it imbalances all the possible colors.
So you got to sit there and watch him conduct the rest of the band in that
sometimes
conducted,
you know,
improvisation.
I did like a vocal piece with him in around 1986 when he was just starting the conduction in a formal concept. And that was all just people using phonemes and things. It was really fantastic. And then I did one with him around 2000 with the Jump Arts Orchestra. And after that, I just kept, Butch, please. But in any event, it put me in a position where, you know, when he died, he said, well, now, you know, I always stayed away from that because that was Butch's thing. Yeah. But I took an assessment and I wrote a piece that was published in Art of Dolia about what I heard in his work, because I think he wasn't the only person to be doing this. Walter Thompson's been doing sound painting. You know, this kind of gestural thing is not unique or even unique to America or any place. It's something that we do. But Butch's intensity and perception he brought to it was that he really brought out an important feature in music that we tend not to think of as the structure of the music, but actually is, which is the flow of information. This is my words, not Butch's exactly. But in that sense, if you take a Euroclassical composition, the flow of information is linear and one-directional. It goes from the composer through the performers to the audience. Perfectly fine. Okay, you start talking about multi-composer music or dialogical rather than monological music, and what you have like in collective improvisation, now what you have is something that all kinds of different things, but things you can't control it anymore. What happens is everything is about influence and not control.
And listening. And responding, right?
And the thing is, though, is that when you have a purely democratic, quote-unquote, free situation, you also end up with a kind of default, too, which is what I've been trying to solve as a composer. So is Butch. But what he did was he put himself kind of at the crossroads where the improvisation came together and redirected the information by way of his gestures.
I see.
And you know, there's a temptation to call it revolutionary, but it's that deep if the word isn't an exact fit. And so I was thinking over those concepts, thinking, well, you know, maybe I feel more comfortable seeing where my place is with that. And then I went to hear Morton Feldman's For Philip Guston, which is a five or six hour long piece. And
what was the instrumentation?
Is
it big?
Oh, no, it's a small piece, like about four or five instruments, certainly involved vibes and gongs and another percussion instrument. I believe piano was in it, maybe a stringed instrument or a wind. It was like four or five, maybe a flute. I can't remember exactly. What I do remember was that, and this is in a lot of Feldman's music, where he repeats figures, but he changes which voice plays the melody. Mm-hmm. So what happens is the timbre, the tone color of the music comes out really emphatically. So, oh, well, I've been doing that. But it wasn't that I wasn't aware of that, but it woke me up to it again. Mm-hmm. And the other one was social political, in the sense that I ran up against using the traditional model of making a band, financing the band, taking the band, dealing with the marketplace, and it wasn't working for me for whatever number of reasons, it's not unique to my situation. So I'm going, how can I do something besides Ronin phasing and create something that's social that has some of these things? And I had been playing, and I still do, with Carl Berger's Improvisers Orchestra. Mm-hmm. And I noticed, of course, a lot of my friends are in the group, but it's not just that. Carl has this thing going where all the proceeds we get from any performance goes to the Creative Music Foundation, which they're trying to catalog all of the recordings made during
the time. They've released some of them.
Yeah, and he's just released some of them.
That's nice.
So we're basically all working pro bono or doing a contribution to it. But I know, you know, there's a lot of people, because the situation is such as we have all these amazing musical intelligences. We're all in a place like New York because we can be together. And if we let the economics stop us, you know, we're not creating our work. It used to be when rent wasn't so high, people had lofts, you could have an alternative world. Right. It's a little different negotiation right now. So I started thinking of the idea, well, what if I took this idea of transparencies and put it together with a modularly organized orchestra? That is to say, using the things that work in nature or even in business, which is redundancy. How do you have it so that, like, when what would happen with sonic openings under pressure, I lose one musician, the whole edifice falls down until I start over again. So go, how can I create something that's flexible enough that no matter who's present or who's not present, the music will still work? Mm-hmm. So I created one, I have a number of them, but I decided I'm going to use just one interface, what people would call a composition, and it can be done, it can be learned in one rehearsal, and then people just have to come to the performances, and I have duplications of all the instruments. I have a pool of about 25 people who enjoy and will make every concert they can make, but nobody has to make any single one. Mm-hmm. So
premiered. You're going to do this at Hugo's place then on Saturday?
We're going to do a relationship that we're doing. We've been doing it in New York since October, and we play about every month or so. I'm doing a Detroit version with all Detroit musicians, only one of whom I've ever even met and heard, and I haven't seen him in a long time. And we're going to do that at Trinosophy's on Friday night, and Saturday night I'm going to come up. And what I wanted to do was take it and talk about how these transparencies are done and why they're done as a composer, but make it a workshop that could work for classical players, could work for jazz players, because this is what's happening, is we're getting this thing to use Anthony Braxton's, we're in a transidiomatic world right now. This is the way it's going. And so, you know, how do you create places where all these different kinds of languages can interface? One way that this works for me, or my particular sculpture out of it, is this transparencies notion. So in the workshop, what we're going to do is talk about, well, how do you make a phrase? For what purpose? A lot of what's really important when you're making music is not just what you do, but why you do it. I mean, one of the reasons we listen, besides that it moves us, is we infer an intelligence that has a whole set of values and reasons and stories behind it. It's not a picture of a story, but it's enmeshed in all those things. So I want to talk about how it's put together, how I compose it, how I put it together. Let's play one. Let's work on a piece. So it'll be, to a certain extent, a rehearsal of a transparency, but complete with all kinds of explanations. Anybody who comes as a participant will go away with two sets of scores to work on. The music, conceivably, for example, the Detroit people have been rehearsing it without me. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually thinking about how this can be, it's like a franchise. It's like I can have a mobile orchestra. I'm thinking, how can I go to Philly? Maybe I can go someplace else and get this sort of thing. And I'm just, for the first half a year, we're just about at that, but it may go longer. I'm just using one interface, which actually was the first one that I did, Rough Hue.
Okay.
And that's what we're going to do in the workshop. I think it would be really useful for any really curious student of music. We're all students, no matter how much we do.
Well, one way to find out about that and to sign up and reserve a spot at the Mexican Sans Frontiers from 2 to 5 this Saturday is by going to the website Transparency, and then it's Kestra with a K, Kestra.org, and then /workshops-classes. So transparencykestra.org/workshops-classes. And you can find out how to hear more of what Patrick is up to in the musical composition of Transparencies at Mexican Sans Frontiers from 2 to 5 this Saturday, with a performance then Saturday night at 8 o'clock of solo saxophone music, as you're hearing live on Blue Lake Public Radio.
Right. And short form would just be Transparency Kestra, you know, via searchengine.org. You'll get to the website and there's a workshops page, or you can go to the Facebook hookups and you'll find the information one way or another.
Beautiful, man. Well, I really appreciate you coming by today and explaining this whole musical world that you've developed for yourself and sharing with everybody else. I was wondering if we could hear one more piece before we sign off here. What do you have in mind?
Well, I'm going to play the mother of Metagroove pieces, which is a piece that I recorded, which I composed in the 80s. It was based on Charles Moore's Snuck In from the CJQ, but I changed a lot of things. But that's where I really learned their version of it and took it to my own. This is a composition called Which Way What, which I recorded with a version of Sonic Openings Under Pressure in 1995, and there's an album by the same name. It's with Rashim Osar Sahu playing bass and a wonderful Portuguese drummer named Acacio Salero.
Will you have those with you when you're at Hugo's?
I am thinking about, it's all technology. I'm actually thinking, because that record's just about out of print, it's on my own label, but I'm actually thinking about doing signed CDRs. Which would, of course, be pretty expensive for anybody who wants them.
Okay, good. Well, that's a good way to find out about your music. Take it home with them and absorb it a little bit more. So this is Which Way What.
That's it.
Patrick Brennan live on Blue Lake Public Radio.